Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Colin Goddard. It's part of our series on remarkable stories of health, courage, and healing. He is a survivor of the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre. And this is his story in a new documentary film about ways to prevent gun violence in America. The film is called Living for 32.
And first, Adam, we have some research that matters. We have some good topics today on ovarian cancer screening, on eating broccoli.
Does it make you live longer, and acupuncture for premenstrual syndrome?
And whether or not it's safe to skip radiation for prostate cancer. Let's talk about the prostate cancer first.
Okay. Well, you know, for all the men out there, for all the spouses of the men, for all the grandparents, parents, this is an important issue because prostate cancer is one of the most frequent cancers in men. And the real question is, what treatments do you really need for, particularly for early prostate cancer? And does, for instance, radiation therapy, is it something that's really needed?
The thing that's remarkable about prostate cancer is that it's usually very slow growing. And so for most people, it may never progress to the point that it threatens a man's life. People say more people die with prostate cancer than without it. And so it makes the treatment options extra confusing.
Right. So this is a new article, Christy. It was in the Annals of Internal Medicine looking at 75 different studies. So one of these combination studies that looks at all these different studies to look at different types of radiation therapy in prostate cancer and the risk of those versus just not having any radiation therapy.
And they were looking at, you know, active surveillance is what they call it, when you sort of watch it and monitor it over time, but don't
do radiation. Which seems weird, doesn't it? I mean, for a lot of people, that might say, well, goodness gracious, you have cancer and you're not doing anything?
Right. Yeah. It's counterculture, counterintuitive to say you have cancer, you're not going to do anything. But it's called active surveillance versus people who have radiation right away. And the interesting thing is that there really was no, not enough evidence to say that waiting, watchful waiting, is any worse or any better than having radiation right away.
Right. And the standard of care for most people still is they're going to get radiation therapy. And there is a clinical trial underway, a worldwide clinical trial, to put half the people in this watchful waiting and the other half to get the radiation. And so until that answer comes about, most people, but not everyone. And I guess for me, a take-home message here, Christy, is if it's me, and I, God forbid, I hope it's not me and my loved ones, but it'll happen to our patients and a lot of men, you need to have a detailed conversation with your provider, your primary care provider, the urologist, the specialist, the oncologist, and talk about what are the benefits, what are the risks, treatment versus no treatment.
It's shared decision making. We talk about that a lot, but in this particular case, it's very important.
Because there are side effects, including incontinence or leakage of urine and not being able to have erections anymore from the radiation treatment. And so you need to weigh those against the potential life-saving aspect of not having cancer.
Well, the next one is about acupuncture. And Adam, we both have voiced support for alternative therapies or at least expanding our minds beyond traditional medicines. And acupuncture is becoming more and more popular in our country. And the question is there evidence to support its benefit for premenstrual syndrome in women?
And this was an article in the International Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology looking at the, again, combination of studies to examine 10 different studies that had looked at this particular issue. And, you know, Christy, I've had acupuncture on my shoulder for pain, so I'm aware of it in a different sort of way than perhaps people. Have you had it too?
I had it for headaches one
for
day.
Headaches?
I had needles all through my face. It
but
helped.
Not for premenstrual syndrome.
Not for premenstrual syndrome.
And certainly I've not had it for, though some people might say I should. But the question really is here is, was it effective? And they say there's not enough evidence to really recommend it. But I think this is like maybe there is some evidence here. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they said there was some studies showing about 50% improvement in PMS syndrome
which
symptoms.
Is that premenstrual syndrome,
Compared with not doing anything. But it's really difficult to tease out and to study acupuncture well because people know if they're getting it or not. And so it's hard to study. I tell patients, if you're able to do this and get your insurance to pay for it or afford to try it, it's worth a try. Very little risk, and it might help. But there's not enough evidence for me to prescribe it.
No, but if compared to perhaps some of the medications, some of the treatments that may be more toxic,
sure,
or have more side effects, I think for some people, if they've tried some of the things, I would support them trying this.
Me too.
Because I don't think the evidence is not to do it. It just is, it may work, and we need stronger evidence.
Absolutely.
What
okay.
do we have next for our next research that matters?
The next is, will eating more broccoli help you live longer? And I hope so, because I've been eating more broccoli lately.
To help you live longer?
Not for that reason, just because I happen to buy more.
Your kid's eating it?
Yeah. Well, my daughter eats it. My son will not.
My daughter loves broccoli. And this research actually that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition looks at 135,000 adults from Shanghai, China. This is a big research study.
And they looked over 5 years, and 4% of that group died. But those who ate the most vegetables or fruit were 15% less likely to die over that period than those who ate the fewest.
Yeah, and it wasn't just broccoli. It was in the category of family plants called mustard. So that included broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower, all the ones that smell awful in your kitchen when you walk in the door, but taste better than they smell.
Yeah, so they tried to rule out other explanations like age, weight, exercise, vitamins, smoking, things that we know are linked to dying early, like smoking in particular. But they could, and they didn't, you know, they were able to isolate as best as they could that eating more of these vegetables and fruits was protective.
And certainly this isn't a causal association. It didn't have any impact on cancer risk, for instance. But doesn't seem to be a downside to me of this, Christy. I think I'm out there supporting it. Of course, I'm vegetarian, but I'm still supporting this because I think it seems to have some benefit and there doesn't seem to be a drawback.
Sure. I'm going to try to get my son to start eating those. We call them baby trees. Okay.
Last research that matters about ovarian cancer screening. And, you know, to be honest with you, Christy, I'm sad to see these results, but I think it's important because a lot of women and their spouses and partners are really worried. And this was recent research in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And this is looking to see if women divided up, they looked at split 70,000 women into two groups, one that got yearly screening for ovarian cancer and one that didn't. And they really found no difference in survival of ovarian cancer. By the time people get symptoms, even with the yearly screening, it tends to be advanced enough that it's not a very good diagnosis to get. And I'm sad to see this because we have ovarian cancer in our family and I want to know how to protect my daughter and what to do. But at this point, we don't have good screening tests.
No, and they did the blood tests along with the ultrasound. And like you said, 212 women in the screening got the ovarian cancer and 118 died and 176 got it without the screening and 100 died. And the biggest problem really with the screening is there were 3,000 false positives in the screening. 1,000 of those had surgery and they didn't have ovarian cancer. And a lot of those had serious infections and complications. And so there was a great cost. I don't think we can recommend this, even though I had the greatest hope. I would
Me
say
too.
Don't do it.
Yeah, it actually causes harm, the screening,
right.
more than
that's
just
right.
not being beneficial.
Well,
so
that's going to conclude what we can do today, Christy. Mm-hmm. But we've had some really, I think, interesting research to talk about. We wouldn't recommend the ovarian cancer screening test.
Talk about eating your broccoli.
Because it may help you live longer.
Talk about acupuncture as a possibility for premenstrual symptoms.
And both of us seem to think that that's reasonable, but we need more evidence.
And about it possibly being safe to skip radiation for prostate cancer.
But at the very least, we do recommend detailed conversations with your providers.
Absolutely. So that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be having a remarkable conversation with Colin Goddard, survivor of the Virginia Tech campus shooting. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Colin Goddard, a remarkable young man who is the Assistant Director for Federal Legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. But he's also the star, the person who really we could name this series of remarkable stories of health, courage, and healing, the survivor of the worst massacre of a school shooting in American history, the Virginia Tech Massacre of April 16th, 2007, and the star of a recent documentary about this experience called Living with 32. Welcome to our show, Colin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Colin, just hearing your story and what you've done in your process of healing is so remarkable. I wonder, you know, as one of seven people to survive this classroom shooting, if you'd be willing to share with us briefly about that experience to frame that for our listeners.
Sure. You know, it's been 4 years since the shooting, and my memory of it has faded a little bit, but in my mind now, today, I still remember some parts as it was yesterday, and I think we'll remember this for the rest of my life. But, you know, as I do remember that day starting, it was quite a normal day for me. I had a Monday morning French class at 9 a.m. that I was up for, getting ready to go to class for. I picked up another student of mine in class, a friend of mine, and we drove to class. And like normal, also in that period of time, my fourth year at Virginia Tech, I was late. We were 5 minutes late to class, and remember I debated with Christina whether or not we should go, whether we should skip or not. We said, no, we should go. You know, it's almost the end of the year. So we ended up getting to class probably about 6 or 7 minutes late, which the teacher was, like I said, she was kind of used to us showing a little bit late. But class began normally. We were conjugating French verbs, speaking with other students about what we did over the weekend, and about halfway through the class, even later than Christina and I arrived, another girl came in late. And this girl, Rachel, was probably one of the best students in the class. And the fact that she showed up more than halfway through the class, we looked at each other puzzled and were like, Rachel, what gives? Why'd you even come? And we remember she turned around and she said, well, there was a shooting in my dormitory this morning and they wouldn't let me leave. And we all looked at each other and said, what? There was a shooting on campus? Like, why haven't we heard about this? You know, if it happened earlier this morning, I had just woken up and checked my email, checked the phone, checked the internet, saw nothing of the shooting. So we were kind of alarmed, but we said, okay, well, you know, they let Rachel leave, so I'm sure they got things under control. Little did we know, well, not even more than 10 minutes after Rachel came in, we started hearing loud banging noises coming from outside of our room. And also at first, we heard the noises, we didn't link it to the shooting that Rachel told us about. We thought it was construction. There were hammers and all sorts of things going on next to us the whole semester, with the building being constructed right next to ours. So we thought it was construction noise. But as the shootings, the bangs got much louder and much closer again, you could tell that this was something that was right outside of our room that was making all this noise. The teacher went to go look into the hallway to see what was making all the noise, and as soon as she opened the door, she slammed it shut and told everybody to get underneath their desk and for somebody to call 911. And it was total shock at that point. This is really happening here. And by the basic, I actually pulled out my phone and the first time ever dialed 911 in a real emergency. Basically got out the basic information of where we were, and we had bullets coming through the door and everybody hit the floor. And the next 10 minutes is probably the longest 10-minute experience of my life.
It sounds unbelievably scary, all the emotions that one could fear happening to oneself and one's friends. And you were one of 17 that were wounded. 32 people died and others injured trying to escape. You yourself were shot.
Four times?
That's correct, at the end of it. You know, the first instance where we had bullets coming through our door and the shooter entered our room, where everybody jumped to the floor, like I said, and seconds after that, I was shot above my left knee. And it wasn't until I was shot the first time before I understood, really, the situation that was happening. It was total shock, total overwhelming, couldn't believe what was happening until it was that moment where I smelt the propellant, smelled like fireworks, when I felt the force of the bullet, when I felt the warm blood dripping down my leg, and all those sensations came together, I realized I've been shot. You know, I could be killed. This is what's going on right now.
And did you see what was, I mean, the people who were dying around you, did you see them getting shot?
Where I was positioned in the room, I was in the back corner of the room, and I was facing the back of the room, not the front. I did take a glance towards the front of the room and saw the shooter from the neck down. I never saw his face, actually. But as I was couldn't see much, I could hear many things. The rest of my senses became much more aware, and I could somewhat figure out where he was depending on the sounds of him shooting, of him reloading and walking around the room, feeling the vibrations of footsteps. And at one point, he was standing right next to me. And he left our room and came back twice. And at the end of it, right before the last gunshot, was one that he gave to himself in his own, in his temple, killed himself. Right before that, I was shot for the fourth time. So the whole 10-minute experience, I was shot above my left knee, both of my hips, and through my right shoulder. Remained very alert, very conscious throughout the whole thing. But, like I said, couldn't really see much. And fortunately for me, most of my closest friends were close physical proximity to me, and everyone who survived in my classroom was located in the same corner of the room. So most of my friends were killed. Most of my friends survived, but my other friends and my professor, who I was very close with, were killed.
Well, I know none of us could really comprehend the magnitude of the loss and the paralysis that I feel even listening to, much less being there. And I know in the film, and we'll talk about in the second segment, the title of the film, Living with 32, this idea of how one really responds and moves on as a survivor. But help us understand, just in the first weeks to months, how did you survive and what happened to you? And because getting shot four times in areas where that one needs to walk and move. And I've, having seen the film, you are a very athletic individual.
Yeah, I feel very fortunate for the physical recovery that I did have. None of the injuries I sustained were life-threatening. None of the bullets that entered my body hit major organs or blood flow passages or nerve centers. And actually, they were located in places to where they remain today. They didn't have to be removed. I still have three bullets out of the four in my body in pieces above my left knee and into my hip. And I have been able to physically recover very, very well and continue to play sports, continue to go to the gym. I think that if I couldn't do some things that I was able to do before, if I had been disabled from certain things moving forward, I think I'd be in a different place mentally and psychologically. I think because my physical recovery went so well, my mental and psychological recovery somewhat followed suit.
So we're going to have to take a break, and I'm looking forward to hearing the next chapter of your life. But you were able to graduate from college, and tell us how you were able to do that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People were very surprised that I chose to go back to Virginia Tech to finish out my degree. I had one more year, but in my mind, there was no other choice. That's where I had settled. That's where my family was. That's where my friends were. That's where my whole life was. And so I wanted to go back to there. I wanted to go back in that environment, to that community, and get better and succeed and prevail.
Well, that certainly required a lot of courage on your part, and really digging deep to be able to reframe and move forward. I think a lot of people might have made a different choice.
Well, I'd gladly report that actually of all 17 injured students, all of them returned and finished their degrees out of Virginia Tech.
Remarkable.
That's remarkable. Well, we're going to need to take a short break. We're talking with Colin Goddard about his experience as a survivor of the worst massacre shooting in college campus in U.S. history. And the film where he stars and explains what he does and why he does, Living for 32. We'll be right back, and we'll discuss how Colin moved to really moving on with his life and really making a difference for others. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Colin Goddard, who is a survivor of the Virginia Tech massacre, one of seven people to survive in this classroom shooting back in 2007, about his remarkable story of health, of courage, of healing, and how he was able to not only survive, but graduate from college and then move forward with his life in a way that is affecting and blessing many people to come.
And Colin, I guess we wanted just to understand now, you partnered really with director Marie Cuomo-Cole on this film, Living for 32. And the title itself suggests that you're not just surviving, but you're living, you're doing something. Tell us about the title and how you started moving in a direction that was really amazing to bring this issue to people across the United States.
All right. Chose the title Living for 32 to remember the 32 Hokies, the 32 Americans who were killed on my school on that day in 2007. But we also chose the title Living for 32 to, I believe, bring light to a greater tragedy, that actually on an average day in this country, there are more than 32 Americans killed by a gun every single day. That's the Virginia Tech that happens every single day that goes unnoticed, because it's not played out on the front page of the newspaper or hour after hour on the radio. And I wanted to have one tragedy expose the greater tragedy that goes unnoted. So we chose Living for 32 to as the title to do just that, to bring people the level of awareness to say that we have a very big problem of gun violence in this country. It is an epidemic. When people realize that, you know, there's actually statistically, Virginia Tech, that happens every single day, I think that's very shocking.
Well, and looking at those statistics from the Center for Disease Control, if it's like 100,000 people in America are shot in a year and 32,000 died from gun violence, it's really, it is really pretty remarkable. And then hearing that you, I guess, once owned a gun or were more, had a different philosophy about guns than perhaps after such a shocking experience. Tell us about that transformation.
Right. Well, I had believed before the shooting incident that gun violence in America was a problem, but I didn't think that it was going to affect me and my family. I thought that if I associated with good people, if I did good things, if I, you know, stayed away from bad places and bad people, that gun violence would be something that doesn't affect my family. And it came and affected me when I was sitting in French class at university. You know, it can happen to anybody. And it changed my whole perspective. I had been familiar with guns. I had been involved in Army ROTC and the Corps of Cadets at Virginia Tech. I'd been to the range a bunch of times with my buddies. I had been hunting before. And so I'm familiar with firearms, but I didn't really know the laws and policies as to how do you get one? What do you have to do? What are the laws there? How do we stop dangerous people from obtaining these weapons? And that's part of the reason why I got involved with the Brady campaigns, because I realized that we do very little to make sure that dangerous people are not easily obtaining firearms. And my question is, why? You know, why do we allow guns to be sold to other people without background checks, for example? I don't believe that to be good public policy.
You know, in the movie, you go to gun shows that I think for most Americans, at least for me, I had never been aware that there's this subculture of these unregulated gun shows where someone like the Virginia Tech shooter, who has been ruled by a judge to be mentally ill, need of hospitalization, who's in imminent danger as a result of his mental illness, but can go and just purchase a gun with huge magazine rounds Tell us a little bit about that experience for you going then to purchase these things.
Right. No, I thought that when you bought a gun in this country, you had to go through, you had to register it, you had to have a license to get one, and come to find out that actually we have no systems of registration. You only need a license if you want to carry it around concealed, loaded in public, and that actually when you went to go buy a gun, it's actually kind of, it's easier to do than buying a beer at a bar at some places. That if there is a individual who doesn't have a license to sell his gun, means he can sell as many of his own personal collection as many times once per year and doesn't have to do a background check on anybody who buys from him. And so I was curious about this, so I wanted to see it real life. And I knew that gun shows were places that were publicly advertised that were, you know, could draw a lot of different people in and would have a lot of people selling guns. So you have a large pool of private sellers with which to buy from. So I went to a bunch of shows in Virginia, in Ohio, in Texas, and in Minnesota with a camera on my shirt. And I just walked up to these guys with a bunch of cash and said, all right, how much for that AK-47? $600? Here you go. And there's the gun, and I walked out.
Really?
And to show people it's really that easy. When people say, oh, well, you know, dangerous people, criminals will always get their guns. There's, you know, there's nothing you can do to stop them. Well, people are getting them very easily this way. Now, this is happening in public underneath our noses.
I think the assumption, or my assumption, has been that there are laws, that there are rules and regulations of how you can get a gun. That's what it seems like they promote, you know, when you hear the news. But I guess that's totally false. Anybody can just walk up and get one.
That's not totally false. If you go to a gun store, for example, you have to go through paperwork and you have to go through a background check. But you have to do that same thing whenever you go through a licensed dealer. If you go through a private seller who can have one gun, who can have 50 guns, you don't have to go through that same standard. And that's my question, is why. These people quite often are selling the same product to the same group of people, yet are held to different standards. And that's my question, is why is that? I don't believe that to be good public policy. I think no matter who you are, no matter where you are, if you sell a gun to someone you don't know, you should run a background check on them first.
Well, it's remarkable to me that you, being the person who has suffered and who has three bullets still in your body, you are the one to raise that question, and that you have taken your suffering and turned that into being the one to shed light on this is truly remarkable.
Well, I am humbled by the large number of Americans who have been involved in this issue for so long, who have been screaming about this, saying, stop selling guns without background checks, and unfortunately have gone unheard. I hadn't heard them to that point. So by having this horrible event in my life, very negative thing, build a platform to where I can promote a positive change, to make positive public policy, to make things that happen to me not less likely to happen to somebody else, then so be it. Then here we are.
Well, so tell us, where are things federally in terms of closing what would seem to me to be a common sense issue for Republicans and Democrats, conservative and liberals, wealthy and less wealthy, men and women? It seems like this is one of those things we could all agree upon. Where are things at federally? And then I want to ask you on follow-up, there is legislation in North Carolina to make it easier to carry concealed weapons. So I want to ask you upon that after we find out where things are at federally.
Well, federally, there is both the bill in the House and the Senate to improve the background check system. It's the Fixed Gun Checks Act. And that would give more missing records to the federal database that the background checks are run from. They would also require that more background checks are done. That would make sure that private sellers are doing background checks too when they sell guns to people they don't know. There are exemptions for old antique weapons, and there are exemptions for family members. But we're talking about, you know, people that you never met, very publicly venues like this that occur. Like I said, in broad daylight.
And then
we're currently seeking support, trying to build more co-sponsors, trying to get enough support for these two bills so that it ultimately gets a hearing, so we have a vote on it, so people can discuss it. And so that's where we're at right now. We're trying to build that support. We're trying to hear from representatives in North Carolina and almost every single state from their constituencies to say, look, I would like my congressman, the person who represents me, to take a stand on this issue and to do something for my public safety.
Well, you know, ironically, of course, the counter is measures that those who perhaps are opposed to what you're doing are trying to get done in legislatures. And I know here in North Carolina, there's a bill in our General Assembly to allow concealed weapons, loaded concealed weapons, in public parks and restaurants where alcohol is served, and exempting firearms and ammunitions that are made in North Carolina from federal regulation. I would assume that this is the sort of legislation that you and your work would not be in any way supportive of.
That's correct. It's part of the general idea that, you know, that the problems of gun violence that we have in this country is because we have a lack of guns in good, responsible hands, is what I hear from law-abiding people. And this is a country of some 300 million people with just about 300 million guns in circulation that we know about. And we have about the highest rate by far of gun violence and gun of us killing each other with firearms than any other industrialized country in the world, and quite often many of them combined.
Well, you know, Colin, we are going to have to wrap up, but our listeners, I mean, one of our missions is to help our listeners be able to be activists and know, to hear these issues and to be able to react in a way that's meaningful. Other than going to the website livingfor32.com, where they can get information and hear about the movie, what else can our listeners do?
There is not a lack of things to do. There are so many. Just understand, first of all, that there are things we can do. There are steps that we can take as a country to try to reduce the likelihood of some dangerous person easily obtaining a gun that we're not doing. And that is improving our background check system. Check out the BradyCampaign.org to find out ways to get involved with your elected officials, because they need to hear from you. You write letters to the editor in your local paper. Get involved in discussions online. You can also check out North Carolina's Against Gun Violence, which is a state organization that's working to affect policies within North Carolina. But basically, when people say, oh, crazy people will do crazy things in this country, Colin, there's nothing you can do about that. You cannot accept that. That is a defeatist mentality that doesn't work to anyone's benefit. So people need to understand that there are things we can do, and adding their voice to this dialogue will be the way we make change.
Absolutely.
Well, Colin,
Thank you, Colin.
We appreciate you adding your voice to your health and our listeners. Appreciate the work that you've done, the work that Marie Cuomo Cole has done as the director, bringing this story to communities. We're looking forward to it coming to the University of North Carolina campus, and we'll certainly promote it. Thanks so much for what you've been doing.
Thank you guys for having me. It's a great talk.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show, we're going to take some time to talk about your health questions and concerns.
And Christy, like always, our guests and listeners can share with us their own ideas and what they'd like to talk about, questions and concerns. They can send them to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we're going to answer some questions from our listeners.
We've got some good ones today, Adam.
We're going to talk about dog bites.
Talk about all-cat testing for gluten intolerance.
Talk about treatments for endometriosis.
And also talk about erectile dysfunction. So let's hear our first question for today.
I have a question. My dog bit my nephew, and it was a hole. It was a deep puncture wound. But for some reason, the doctor didn't sew it up. Can you explain that to me, please?
Well, I'm sorry that, you know, that the situation happened with the dog.
Your dog biting your nephew.
Yeah.
That sounds like a double whammy. I hope you have a good relationship with your with your brother or sister-in-law.
Yeah, I would agree. And it is confusing with bites, because sometimes they can be significant, and yet we don't always sew them up. We particularly do not sew up human bites and cat bites, because they almost always get infected, and closing them up is not a great idea. But with dog bites, there's some judgment.
Yeah, and certainly if it's a deep a puncture wound, there might be some concern that you have some tissue deep that might end up dying, and they may be concerned, given that nature, that you wouldn't sew it up. And then sometimes if it's more than 12 hours after the bite, they may not sew it up. Again, concerns about infection.
And also, doctors often don't close it up if it looks already infected, or if it's on the hand or the foot, we might be more likely to let that heal on its own. So without seeing it or knowing more about it, it's hard to say exactly why, but I hope that your nephew is getting better soon, and that the family is getting along okay.
And that the dog has had its rabies shots. And
we didn't talk about that.
And whatever may have occurred, that we try to prevent this. Because, you know, a lot of times we think, oh, dog bites aren't preventable. But sometimes they are. And I think we need to take some time, Christy, to talk about ways of preventing animal bites.
That'd be great. Let's take our next question, Adam. This is about the all-cat testing.
So do you believe in the all-cat test? And if it works, I feel like sometimes I might have an allergy to gluten. I just wondered if the all-cat test would show true results.
Thank you for asking that question and for sharing it with us. You know, I had to actually look up what this all-cat testing was, Adam. This company that tests you for like 200 different, you know, food allergies and chemical allergies. And it's really interesting to see what is being marketed out there.
Yeah, and you know, there are lots of tests out there increasingly that are being marketed to people to diagnose conditions. And food allergies, food sensitivities are one of them that's probably more frequent. And we do know from our prior work, Christy, that this is something that's overdiagnosed that suggests that people have these allergies that in a lot of times doesn't exist. And then the real question on this particular case is this effective truly at diagnosing gluten, which is a major problem, versus maybe some other tests that we know about?
Well, and allergy societies throughout the world have come out of position statements on this. And it was also on that Quack Watch, Adam. We had a guest a while back who sort of finds medical quackery where people, you know, claim things that may not be true. In this case, a lot of allergy societies, including the American Academy of Allergy and Asthma and Immunology, have stated that there is not scientific evidence to support this all-cat testing of being anything that's necessarily helpful to patients from a science level.
Yeah, and you know, we do know that there are a variety of abnormalities in people who have gluten sensitivity. They frequently have abnormalities of iron levels, vitamin D levels. And so if you have some of these abnormalities and some of the symptoms, you probably, you know, should get tested. But, you know, some of the testing that's done in people in physicians' offices, these tests have some proven reliability, and they're not inexpensive tests, but you know what, you're doing it in conjunction with your physician instead of being given a potentially lifelong diagnosis that may not be true.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Adam. I'd say go and talk with your doctor about this. If your doctor's not familiar with gluten sensitivity or tests for allergy, an allergist or immunologist could be helpful. But do that in conjunction with a doctor you trust.
You can read about a little bit about this, what someone who's really followed this at quackwatch.com, and you know, we'll make sure we have a link on that on our site as well. So I hope that's useful. What's our very next house call?
Hi, I have a question. I'm 42 years old, and I've always had really terrible cramps and endometriosis. And lately, they're so bad that my doctor has been recommending ablation. But boiling my uterus sounds kind of scary to me. Are there other options? Should I look into a hysterectomy, or would an IUD make any difference? I'd love any advice you can give me. Thanks.
Sounds like that's a very difficult issue. So first off, thanks for sharing sometimes something that's painful and difficult because it's probably something that a lot of women and their families really have out there. It's probably more common than people talk about.
And if you're 42 years old and you're done having children, then a definitive option like a hysterectomy is reasonable. It sounds like that's what your doctor may have suggested. The ablation therapy that you're talking about, which is a procedure where a doctor can sort of destroy that inner lining of your uterus, can also be very effective, as can an IUD, like the Mirena IUD that has some hormone in it.
Yeah, I know when you say boiling my uterus,
it sounds awful.
It does sound a lot more awful. And, you know, when we do things like applying liquid nitrogen to hit skin cells, we don't usually say we're destroying your epidermis, but we're saying we're taking care of the problem. And so perhaps maybe it's reframing sometimes, but most of these therapies are effective. And, you know, I think like you just said, Christy, part of it depends on whether you really want to preserve your uterus if you're thinking about having children or you want to avoid a major surgery.
I also think it depends on, I mean, having your uterus out, although it's a common procedure, it is a surgery. Whereas the ablation therapy or the Mirena IUD, those are procedures that are much less, I mean, they're just not quite as definitive, or certainly the IUD is something you could change your mind and remove that can be done right in the office.
And whether or not even the endometriosis is confined inside the uterus may have some impact, because if you can have
the
endometrial
Mirena could be helpful.
Implants even on the ovaries. So, mm-hmm. But if it was just in the uterus, hysterectomy, leaving the ovaries might be an option. So you've got lots of questions. We've raised more questions, but hopefully a few answers.
Mm-hmm. There are good rates for all three in decreasing bleeding and patient satisfaction. So do talk further with your family and with your doctor about these decisions, and we wish you the best of luck.
Let's listen to our very last house call today about Viagra.
Doc, these are tough economic times, and with Viagra being $10 a pill, I'm researching alternatives. I was wondering what the effectiveness of an Extends pill would be.
Thank you for asking a difficult question. This is one of those things that we don't often talk about because it is so private, and sometimes people are uncomfortable. I had to look up Extends. I have to admit, I had to look it up online, and when I did, I got a lot of
extraneous
pictures.
Information that you didn't necessarily want on your computer.
I did. I did not want those on my computer, but I had to look it up so we could answer your question.
And what you're really talking about here is, yes, the medications like Viagra and its cousins Cialis or Levitra, they are expensive, and $10 a pill, getting it in the United States, is not uncommon, and you're limited to the number of pills you can have. So we understand why people might want to investigate alternative products that promise outcomes but could be cheaper. So let's first all talk about this promised outcomes. What is Extends, first all? And then second, does it work?
So what it is a group of different herbal remedies. It's got L-arginine, which is an amino acid, ginseng, oat straw, nettle. It's got yohimbe in it. So it's a combination of different herbal products and is marketed to do a lot of different things.
Increasing the size of the penis, increasing the performance during intercourse. It has actually a lot of claims to it, which automatically makes us in medicine, when any one product has lots of claims, we want to say, let's see the evidence. And unfortunately, we couldn't find evidence that this is effective.
No evidence that it's effective. And with the claims being so grand, it's highly suspicious.
There's probably a strong placebo effect. Mm-hmm. So perhaps if you are paying for it and you're using it and you feel that there's some impact, I don't know if there's a harm to that, but we would not recommend this over products that we know what they do. We know their costs. We also know the side effect profile. We don't know the side effect profile. It may not be very large, but it may be real.
I would be wary. We're in agreement of that, Adam. Thank you for your question. Thanks to all of you for calling in and for being with us today. We hope we've had a chance to answer some questions about you and your health.
Yep. Christy, our listeners can let us know at yourhealth.unc.edu. They can go to our website, www.yourhealthradio.org. They can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and free podcasts from the iTunes Store.
So many ways to reach us. We want to thank the staff of WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Colin Goddard, for the remarkable work he's doing. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.